fans of rank political hypocrisy can rejoice, for the Corker is back. That'd be Bob Corker, the multimillion-dollar real estate developer who's now a U.S. Senator from Tennessee. He first burbled up into public consciousness last December by hurling rhetorical bombs at Detroit's unionized auto workers, asserting that their pay packages are so outrageously high that they are the reason the industry is on financial life support. Corker demanded that as a price for getting federal bailout money, GM and other American companies tear up their union contracts and bust the wages of their workers down to the level of non-union foreign auto factories in Tennessee. First, what a hoot to hear a rich senator who draws $165,000 a year from us taxpayers jumping on middle-class workers who don't average a third of that pay. Second, it turns out that while experienced unionized auto workers get about $28 an hour, that's barely more than the $25 an hour that Nissan pays its workers in Tennessee. But now comes strike three for the hypocritical senator. He's discovered that, whoops, there's a unionized General Motors plant in his own state, and his attacks on the union have made him less popular there than a tornado in a trailer park. "We're deeply disappointed in Corker," said a union official, adding, "That's the official union statement, but actually, my members want to choke him." So guess who is now demanding that any restructuring of GM by Obama's car bailout czar must spare the Tennessee plant from cuts or closure? Right, the Corker. Suddenly, the guy who tried to mandate wage cuts for Detroit auto workers is at the barricades in his state, plaintively singing Solidarity Forever. This is Jim Hightower saying, Corker's shameless hypocrisy is so glaring, it can be seen from the space station with a naked eye.
KOP, Hornsby Austin. KOP.org on the World Wide Web. Thanks to Jim Hightower for the incisive commentary. And to Isidoro Lopez for the lively music. People United starts now.
Pueblo unido jamás será vencido.
El pueblo unido jamás será vencido. El pueblo unido jamás.
Want to be a part of Co-op Radio and get your own show here on your community radio station? Then join us for our programmer orientation on Monday, May 11th at 7 p.m. at the Moose Lodge at 2103 East E.M. Franklin Avenue in East Austin. We'll be telling you about how you can get started at Co-op and perhaps eventually get your own program. So save the date. That's Monday, May 11th at 7 p.m. at the Moose Lodge on E.M. Franklin Avenue. Check KOP.org, that's co-op.org, for all the information. You're listening to People United, the show in solidarity with the people of the world. I'm Alan Campbell. With us this week is Shan Speed, who's an assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Texas at Austin. We're going to be talking about her book, Rights in Rebellion, Indigenous Struggle and Human Rights in Chiapas. Shannon Speed, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Alan. It's nice to be here.
And your book spends a lot of time talking about so much a variety of issues. This actually comes from a dissertation you did, I believe, at UC Davis. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And why don't you talk about how you became interested in Chiapas, indigenous communities, the Zapatistas, and so much more?
Sure. As you say, I was a doctoral student at UC Davis in anthropology and Native American studies, and I had been an activist for a number of years. I was interested in social movements, resistance movements, and I began my doctoral program in 1994, which was precisely the year that an indigenous uprising began in Chiapas in the southern state of Mexico. And that uprising, of course, garnered a lot of interest from a lot of folks around the globe. It certainly caught my attention because it encompassed so many of the social dynamics that I was interested in. And so in 1995, I went to Chiapas to see if I could engage in research there, and that's where the book began.
The Zapatista uprising happened on January 1st, 1994, which is also the first day that NAFTA was officially in effect.
That's right.
In your book, you talk about the changes in the Mexican Constitution leading up to NAFTA's implementation after its signing in 1992.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about how the Constitution both set the stages for both neoliberalism as well as multiculturalism.
Sure. One of the reasons I found the uprising so interesting, and it was such an interesting time, was that resistance movements were coming out of a period where we had sort of more broad-based discourses, socialist-type discourses, and really the left, I think, was in sort of a period of flux as neoliberal capitalism spread throughout the world in this seemingly sort of inevitable march. And in Latin America, we saw that spread manifested in Mexico in the North American Free Trade Agreement and in other places with constitutional changes that both liberalized the economy, opened the economy for a greater neoliberal policy, and at the same time recognized the rights of indigenous people and other minority groups. And often, like in Mexico, these changes came together in the very same packet of reforms. And in Mexico, these happened just prior to NAFTA under Carlos Salinas de Gortari. And so for the first time in Mexico, a constitution which had never in the history of the country so much as mentioned the presence of indigenous people suddenly recognized their them as a fundamental component of the populace. It seemed to me impossible that it was simply coincidence that this, what was we would regard as good, a recognition of indigenous rights, was so linked up with these neoliberal reforms that in many ways were so harmful for the population. And we could talk about the specific things that happened in those reforms, if you'd like, elimination of land reform and other things that were made it virtually impossible for the indigenous population to maintain its culture and stay alive.
Well, why don't we get further into neoliberalism? And I think that's kind of unavoidable, really, when you look at the struggles in Chiapas and Mexico in general. But what I'm interested in hearing about just right at this moment, though, is why you think recognition of indigenous communities by Mexico was necessarily a necessary accompaniment to Mexico, the Mexican government giving up its role as guarantor of social welfare?
Well, a new social pact needed to be defined. In Mexico, a social pact that followed the Mexican Revolution, which was a populist revolution, created an authoritarian corporatist state, which was one in which there was a dominant ruling party for seven decades, and in which the state essentially sponsored different segments of the population, particularly potentially rebellious populations such as labor or indigenous people, through giant state agencies like the giant state labor unions, etc. And in that way, maintained power through sort of getting these different segments of the population invested in the ongoing well-being of the ruling party, right? Because their well-being depended on that. However, that required extensive social investment. And after the economic crisis of the 1980s and as Mexico increasingly integrated into the neoliberal world market, it was no longer able to engage in that kind of massive social investment. It had to shrink the state down, withdraw the state from intervention in the economy, denationalize so that foreign capital could come in. And that required a very different kind of relationship to the population, one that allowed the state to maintain its power, but in a different way. And so Charlie Hale, for example, in Guatemala has looked at the emergence of a neoliberal multiculturalism, which recognizes indigenous rights, but in a manner that is circumscribed enough that only compliant or good Indians fit in, and those who are more contestatory are somehow sort of deauthorized or dequalified from indigenousness. And I think that Mexico and a number of other countries were on that path. Many countries continued on that path. Mexico, I argue, stopped. In 1992, when it passed the constitutional reforms, it was on that path. But it withdrew from that path after the Zapatista uprising.
Again, I'm still not clear why the state felt obliged to recognize indigenous peoples in Mexico. At the same time, it set the stage for neoliberalism in the Constitution.
The state needed to get the different segments of the population, particularly those most marginalized and therefore most potentially rebellious, somehow once again invested in the state or tied to the state. And because it could no longer do this through social investment, it was attempting to do it through recognition, right? So indigenous people suddenly had some potential rights that could be gained from the state in this multiculturalist context.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the way that the Zapatista uprising and the Zapatista movement after 1994 set the stage for a new discourse regarding indigenous communities.
Sure. You know, the change to the Constitution recognizing Mexico's indigenous population was important, although it was limited in terms of what it provided in terms of rights. But it was the Zapatista uprising that really put indigenous people on the political map, on the political landscape, on the political agenda in Mexico. Up until the Zapatista uprising, people were often surprised to hear that there were huge segments of the Mexican population that had no idea that there were any indigenous people remaining in Mexico. The national discourse of mestizaje or racial mixing was a very successful hegemonic discourse, which posited that there was a Mexican population made up of a mix of Spaniard and Indian, and that all Mexicans were this mix, but that the country was made up of a homogeneous populace of mestizos, of mixed people. And so many, many people throughout Mexico were not even aware that there were indigenous communities remaining in the country.
That would have been the dominant race paradigm before the onset of neoliberalism in Mexico, the notion of the cosmic race.
Exactly.
Let's talk a little bit about criteria for indigenous communities, those that were set up by the state and the way those were challenged in the years after 1994.
Okay, well, really this, let's talk about the modern period, or in other words, post-revolution. The Mexican, the newly emerging
revolution
state.
Revolution
with
a lowercase,
capital R.
Wait, but you mean after the Zapatistas went above ground?
No, okay, I'm sorry. I'm talking about the Mexican
so
Revolution
you do mean,
in 1910. Yes.
You do mean that revolution.
Yes,
okay, just
the one,
to be clear
the one
on
with
that.
The capital R.
Right.
There was a newly emergent state in Mexico that needed to consolidate its populace and the different groups that had been a part of the popular uprising, sort of consolidate them into a hegemonic state project. One of the ways that they attempted to assimilate, they had developed assimilationist policies for indigenous people. One of the ways that they assimilated indigenous people was through this discourse of la raza cósmica, which is the cosmic race. It's a notion that was coined, the term was coined by José Vasconcelos, who was the first minister of education after the revolution. It's exactly what I said. The cosmic race was this blending of Spaniard and Indian into a new cosmic race. But that was sort of the discourse end of it, but there were also concrete policies enacted that served to eliminate or segments of the Indian population. One of the ways was by defining groups completely out of existence. So by setting criteria, for example, for the census that eliminate a lot of folks, like saying indigenous people are those people who speak as a first language an indigenous language, live in rural communities and wear indigenous dress, that eliminated anyone who left an indigenous community, migrated to a city, etc. And so that it was those were policies that were specifically enacted to reduce that population. With the Zapatista uprising, all of those categories got called into question.
You spend a lot of time in your book focusing on the community of Nicolás Ruiz and their identification during these different land struggles as campesinos and then only later as indigenous people. And that kind of runs parallel with the way the Zapatistas, in the course of their failed negotiations with the government, also change the agenda of their struggle. You want to talk about both those parallel developments?
Sure. I had the great honor to work in the community of Nicolás Ruiz, which is a community in the central zone of the state of Chiapas. It's a zone that's not traditionally qualified as indigenous, and this community was formed in about 200 years ago by a small group of Tzeltal Indians. There was very little in or out migration. It's a rural community. So the descendants who live there now, just under 4,000 people, are all descendants of those original families. However, over the course of the 20th century, as the Mexican government strongly asserted an agrarianist discourse for dealing with its rural population, the community, as it struggled for lands that were slowly but surely being taken away from it, adopted this dominant discourse because it was the most useful one for interacting with the government. So they said, you know, they would use terms like we, the people who worked the land, you know, a campesinist peasant sort of discourse in these struggles. And over the course of 30 or 40 years, in the mid-20th century, they began to stop wearing their traditional dress, and eventually by the 60s, there were no longer any speakers of the Tzeltal language in the community. So it was defined then as a campesino community, period. However, in the 1990s, when they began to engage in organized resistance with the Zapatista movement, and as you say, the Zapatista movement emerged with a fairly strong peasant type discourse, campesinas discourse, but fairly quickly merged into more of an indigenous rights discourse for a variety of reasons. The community of Nicolás Ruiz began to rethink its own identity, and as they became involved with an indigenous movement and a struggle for indigenous rights, they began to look at their own past and their own history and say, wait a minute, we're indigenous people too, and they decided at one point, it took the overt move of voting in the communal assembly to redefine themselves, to reassert their Tzeltal identity in the international, in the context of an international legal case.
Talk a little bit about the international legal case.
That was a case before the International Labor Organization for under its Convention 169 on Indigenous and Tribal Peoples, which at that point in time was the most important piece of international legislation on indigenous rights. And the lawsuit challenged the Mexican government for violating the rights of the people of Nicolás Ruiz, for not allowing them the right to self-identification, which is included in the Convention 169, and not allowing them to maintain their territory, and that was part of the land struggle.
So, and this also kind of coincides with the kind of opening provided by the neoliberal multiculturalism of the revised Mexican Constitution.
Right. So suddenly you've got a community that's been engaged in a land struggle for over a century, and they are operating in a new context, right? They were under authoritarian corporatism. They were working through agrarian reform to try to reclaim their lands. But they're working in a new context. In the neoliberal context, agrarian reform has been all but eliminated. The campesinas discourse is no longer in fashion. Everyone's talking about indigenous rights. Both the state discourse has shifted towards one of multiculturalism, and indigenous rights are on the agenda, and the social movement they're involved in has forefronted this. And so I think fairly naturally they began to reassess their own community identity and forefront what I would, what I want to emphasize is that I don't think this was just a strategic move to sort of falsely portray themselves as newly Indian, but rather forefront a different aspect of their identity than they were forefronting previously.
one of the things you write in your book is that rather than just being pure opportunism, there's also a kind of interest in one's own indigenous identity.
Absolutely. And they, you know, that was one of the things that working closely with this community allowed me to see. I mean, I think it would be easy from the outside to look at this as just a strategic move on their part. But it was very clear to me that while they're clearly strategic and they're smart political operators, they've been in this struggle for a long, long time, that this was very important to them to be able to reinsert their identity as indigenous people. And I think that, that came from something much deeper than just, you know, political strategy.
And again, getting back to the state, there's this notion of criteria for who is an indigenous person and what is an indigenous community. It was to the benefit of the state to have the criteria be circumscribed enough that arguably, in many cases, indigenous people don't exist. They're becoming assimilated. They're not wearing traditional dress. They're not speaking their traditional tribal language.
They live in Mexico City.
They live in Mexico City. Now, you come into this as somebody who's interested in the struggles in Mexico, but also are within a U.S. context. An indigenous person, you're a mixed descent Native American. Why don't you talk about the criteria that makes you a Native American in this country and then makes your recognition as an indigenous person, say, in Mexico considerably different?
Sure. I am, as you say, a mixed descent Native American. I'm a citizen of the Chickasaw Nation, and that citizenship is based on descent through my father. In the United States, most tribes are defined, the citizenship or membership is defined by descent, and that's the primary criteria, although many tribes, in the awareness that precisely because it's the people who resisted being documented and disciplined by the state, by the government, that have the hardest time demonstrating their descent. Some tribes do allow membership based on self-identification, on self-ascription.
In the U.S.
In the U.S., right. But that is not the case for the Chickasaw Nation that I'm a tribal member of. But we should say that I look white. I'm also of European descent, so I'm not readily identified by looking at me as a Native American for whatever that means in the U.S. context. And certainly I'm not readily identified by anyone in Mexico as an Indian, right? So it would be, in fact, very difficult for Indian people of Mayan descent in southern Chiapas to interact with me as an Indian. For a whole host of reasons, but principally my parents.
You were generally acknowledged as a gringa.
Right, exactly. So it's in which is a kind of identity shift that takes place when I cross the border that involves a whole series of things. So in the United States, whether or not people identify me readily as a Native American is based on what I look like. But in Mexico, I'm also carrying the privilege that comes with being from the United States and, you know, all that carries with it as well. So there was a whole other bundle of issues there that were very important for me because I was trying to engage in a collaborative research project that, that continually interrogated the relationship of power between me and the people that I was working with and simultaneously studying. So when I came into Nicolás Ruiz, of course, I came bearing all of my own thoughts about Native American identity and Indian identity, and I should say also that I worked on this case before the International Labor Organization, and as an anthropologist, it was my work in that case to demonstrate that, in fact, they were indigenous people, because that was the basis of their claim. They had to demonstrate that they were indigenous or they couldn't make the claim. I was very interested in doing so because what we were doing was challenging precisely the criteria that you've mentioned that the Mexican government was using to identify and to de-identify indigenous people, so language and dress in particular. And the people of Nicolás Ruiz, the authorities of Nicolás Ruiz, were told by the government, you know, you can talk to us about indigenous rights when you come speaking Celta. So, you know, the government's position was clear. If they didn't speak the language, they had no claim to any kind of rights to territory, to self-identification, to anything else. So I wanted to challenge those precisely because I was thinking not only about indigenous people in Mexico and what that meant for them, but for Native Americans in the United States. If we were to identify Native Americans only by language and dress in the United States, we'd eliminate probably half the Native American population right off the bat.
Not to mention the fact that there are laws anyway that continue to disqualify different peoples in the United States as Native Americans.
Absolutely, there certainly are. There are other ways that it's done in the United States, right? But these two criteria were ones that I viewed as particularly dangerous.
I want to take a break here, get to a couple of messages. And for those tuning in late, I'm talking with Shannon Speed, who's an assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Texas at Austin. We're talking about, in particular, her book, Rights and Rebellion, Indigenous Struggle and Human Rights in Chiapas. We're talking about indigenous communities, the state, the Zapatista movement, and the discourse of human rights. So please stick around. The show's People United. I'm Alan Campbell, and here is this word.
Underwriting co-op says a lot about your business. As a co-op underwriter, you join a community of people who are passionate about public radio. When you invest in co-op, you're investing in a valuable service that informs, educates, and inspires. Co-op Community Radio has the ears of Austin residents. They're curious, creative, intelligent, and active in the community. To find out more about joining the co-op community by becoming an underwriter, go to koop.org or call 512-472-1369. That's 472-1369.
Support for Co-op comes from the 9th Annual Mali Women's Festival, Film and Performance Art Festival, I should say, from May 28th through the 31st, showcasing film, music, art, and poetry by women artists with a sustainability theme. Mali Women's Film and Performance Art Festival will be held at the Long Center, Cafe Mundi, Hot Mamas, Green Muse, and the Austin Youth Hostel. For more information and tickets, you may visit blowinguspot.com or you may call 1-800-838-3006. You're listening to People United, the show in solidarity with the people of the world. I'm Alan Campbell. This week we're talking with Shannon Speed, assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Texas at Austin. Shannon Speed is the author of Rights and Rebellion, Indigenous Struggle and Human Rights in Chiapas. A moment ago we were talking about your position as somebody who's both a mixed descent Native American woman, but also somebody who is privileged for a number of reasons, one of which being that you're a U.S. national coming into a poor, rural, indigenous, self-identified community in Chiapas. One of the things I also want to talk about is as a U.S. national in the 1980s, before you became an anthropologist, you were involved in activism against U.S. policies in Central America. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. As I said at the beginning, I've been a political activist for a long time, and I was very opposed to U.S. policy in Central America and the dirty little wars that the U.S. had going on there at that time. I lived in Nicaragua for a year and a half altogether in the mid-1980s and was engaged in what I think any of us would have characterized as solidarity work at that time. So solidarity work in the 80s meant doing political work in support of people who were struggling to throw off the yoke of U.S. imperialism and imposing U.S. imperialism in that way. That political model was heavily critiqued by the end of the 1980s, of course, for its paternalism and for a variety of reasons.
Why don't you elaborate a little bit on the paternalism?
Well, I think that kind of solidarity was based on the idea that, you know, we should go down and help other people, right? And you know, there's an argument in favor of that. We were in a position of power. We came from the U.S. We had the resources to go there and do that kind of support work. And a lot of people did an awful lot of very good work in Central America and other places, of course, in the 1980s. But there were a lot of critiques of that, some of them very valid. And there were critiques not just of sort of the paternalist impulse of wanting to go help those folks down there.
This would be like, in your case, you'd be in Nicaragua at the very same time that the U.S. had imposed an embargo
on
that country, in addition to funding the Contra War.
That's right, and I was working for the Ministry of Natural Resources and the Environment of the Sandinista government. But there were other important aspects to those critiques, one of which was its failure to interrogate the power dynamics between those who came to do solidarity work and those who lived and struggled in those places, mm-hmm. right? And so that was something that I came away from the 80s with. And in the 90s, when I became active in Chiapas, and I defined my academic project as an activist research project from the start, I was very interested in sort of keeping that interrogation as a central part of what I was doing, because it's a problem both for activists going elsewhere to work and for anthropologists who go elsewhere to study other people as their research subjects.
Well, this might be an opportunity to get into one of the things I was hoping to talk about this hour in the context of discussing your book, which is the activism, academia, binary, which you have hoped to challenge all in your book, but also as a teacher and a scholar of other works as well. Let's talk about the anthropology end, because, I mean, obviously, anthropology has both its own kind of less than golden era in the area of ethnography in ways that kind of validated imperialistic discourses.
Absolutely.
And then gone through different phases and ways to be less ethnocentric and condescending toward other cultures. One of the things in your book is challenge what at one point had been a sort of attempt at what for lack of a better word, we'll call a politically correct paradigm of not judging other cultures, and you're moving toward one that actually sees the use of a notion or an idea of universal human rights, but at the same time does so in a way that gives deference and validation to the struggles of local communities. And I guess, is there anything, first of all, that you want to elaborate about changes that have happened in your field of anthropology?
It's a very broad field, and a lot of different things have happened. Anthropology does have, as you say, a very fraught history, a history of collaboration and collusion with colonialism, whether intentional or unintentional. I mean, anthropology, perhaps more than any other discipline, social science discipline, emerged from, is a product of the colonial project. Initial anthropological work was generated by and facilitated by the existence of colonial relations, and our representations of people during colony frequently supported because they emerged from colonial logics, they sort of reinscribed those or supported colonial logics in ways that facilitated ongoing colonialism. Anthropology was heavily critiqued as the world decolonized, and those newly emergent post-colonial states and research subjects became much more contestatory. And anthropology went into, along with those post-colonial critiques, there were strong critiques launched from feminists and to some extent from postmodernists of the anthropological project of representing others with a capital O, or other people's cultures. The critiques were so strong that anthropology really went into a serious tailspin and went through a moment of crisis. In fact, it was called the crisis of representation. in the 1980s. And since that time, anthropology has struggled to find a way forward, to do anthropological work, ethnographic work, without engaging in sort of a negative politics of knowledge production, one in which we go in, take information about people, and write our representations of them based on what is ostensibly our expert knowledge of their culture, leaving them as sort of passive subjects who get represented, and ignoring the fact that the representations that we make are A, subjective, and B, have political effects for those people that we write about. And so I think activist research is one way of attempting to address the politics of knowledge production by both acknowledging upfront that our research is subjective, right? That we can't sort of step outside of our own political beliefs in order to look at a social process and describe it accurately as a reality. And by addressing the fact that whatever we produce is going to have political effects on them, whether or not, you know, we see it as subjective or objective. Mm-hmm. So an activist project that's overtly defined in alignment with a community and that has commitments, political commitments entailed within it, I think helps to address those issues. It certainly doesn't eliminate them, and I'm not certain that they can be completely eliminated in an anthropological research project.
Now, there's this, getting back to notions of, I guess, universal values, and particularly with an idea of universal human rights. I mean, this is something that has implications far beyond your own discipline of anthropology, and is something you actually write about with regard to human rights as activated through three kinds of law: natural law, positive law, and what you call indigenous law. Why don't you talk a little bit about those in the context of your research in Chiapas?
Sure. I was struggling with human rights because I've been a human rights activist for a long time, and I do subscribe to some extent to notions of the existence of some form of universal human rights. However, I also saw the intimate links between human rights and neoliberalism, neoliberal multiculturalism in Latin America. And so I wanted to think through a number of these complex issues. In human rights studies, there is no more heavily debated issue than the question of universalism and cultural relativism. The universalism question being whether or not there can be some kind of universal norms that apply to all people of all cultures, and the cultural relativist position being that that's impossible because it only represents the imposition of Western norms on all the peoples of the world, because, of course, the universal human rights as we know them today and as is inscribed in international law are Western norms that emerged from Enlightenment thought, et cetera. So one of the things I wanted to do was look at, in the particular context of Chiapas, you know, where the notions of universal rights were coming from, how they had emerged, and what was happening with them as they were understood and interpreted by indigenous people on the ground. And I really found that there were different sort of trajectories of notions of rights or discourses of human rights in Chiapas. The first was one that came through natural law and through the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church remains very influential in Chiapas. And this is a notion that, at its heart, says that all people have rights as children of God, and ultimately the referent for those rights is the sovereign, is God. There's another model that comes through positive law legal systems, through the Constitution, which says that all people have rights as citizens of a state, and the sovereign, of course, in that model that provides those rights, that brings those rights into existence, is the state itself. And then I argue that, you know, that indigenous people have, drawing on those two different trajectories, and particularly through the Zapatista movement, mobilize a discourse of rights in a slightly different way. I mean, it's kind of hard to say how I came to this conclusion without explaining a long, a 10-year history of organizing around indigenous rights, but essentially, the Zapatistas came to a point where they said, the government is never going to recognize our autonomy. We don't need our right to autonomy to be recognized. It already exists because we're already practicing it on the ground. So the Zapatista Autonomous Project, which had been developing at that point for 10 years, was underway. It was in existence, even though it was not recognized by the Mexican state. So what they did was actually say, our rights exist prior to the state being recognizing them or making laws that make those rights formal. So they made sort of a double move that drew on a lot of the different trajectories of rights discourses that they had been in contact with.
Liberation theology being one of them.
Absolutely.
They talk about rights with regard to those being exercised and claimed rather than be granted by the state.
Exactly.
Let's talk a little bit about the state and its relation to self-identified indigenous communities. And because it's part of your research, we can look at Nicolás Ruiz in particular. You have a chapter about women. And one of the things I thought about when reading this chapter was the way feminist rhetoric is opportunistically used in this country in the name of military intervention in other countries, certainly in Afghanistan. And this is something that happens just within a country. This is an intranational situation where you have the people in the state of Mexico talking about the need to intervene in indigenous communities. There's one official who hypothesizes the prospect of baby sacrifice. And so one of the things you talk about is individual and collective rights with regard to gender and the way in which women can never be just a platonic ideal of women without also being one and the same, a member of an indigenous community. Why don't you talk a little bit about the challenges made by women within indigenous communities without the reliance on intervention from the state in terms of progress of women?
Okay, sure. Yes, I found it remarkable that George W. Bush suddenly developed such a strong concern for how the Taliban was violating Afghan women's rights in 2001, no, and with no prior concern. And a very similar thing happened in Mexico when indigenous rights and autonomy got put on the national agenda and in the national debate. A rather vocal group of intellectuals in Mexico argued that indigenous people could not be given the right to total autonomy because they were inherently anti-democratic and they would violate the rights through the exercise of their collective right to maintain their customs and practices. They would violate the rights of individuals within the community. And most frequently, this manifested as a concern for the rights of indigenous women. So that if indigenous communities were given autonomy, they would rampantly violate the rights of indigenous women. Mostly these very vocal critics had never given a whit about indigenous women previously. Nevertheless, they were drawing on the words, the rhetoric, and in some cases the studies that feminists had carried out that looked at the ways indigenous women are oppressed within their communities. So they were sort of appropriating that feminist discourse and redeploying it for political ends in a way that was really problematic. And indigenous women saw it as so and responded to it. I'll tell you a little bit about Nicolás Ruiz. There was a conflict among organized women in Nicolás Ruiz, and one woman leader who was very had become very prominent and was, you know, often seen at political rallies with a megaphone and was really sort of an ode to her circulated on the internet. She was really respected and by folks sort of in the NGO world and other activists as this really dynamic, smart woman that she was and is. But within the community, people were beginning to feel very uncomfortable with her, and ultimately the women's group split over her leadership because they felt that she was too much of an individualist leader, that she was a protagonista, in their words.
And that would be somebody who is involved with something for personal gain and prestige.
Well, anyone who asserts their identity individually is perceived as doing so for individual gain and prestige in indigenous communities. In Chiapas, where people live in a collective context and where certainly there are differentiations in wealth and status in communities, but they're minimized. Decisions are made collectively, frequently by the men and not the women. But in communities, there are a great deal of social efforts made to see that individuals don't assert themselves in any way as being more important in the community. So she was, after the split, she ended up being, a variety of things happened, as you can imagine, but she ended up being censured by the community. And a number of feminist activists rushed to her defense and argued that it was the male authorities of Nicolás Ruiz who were shutting her down because they were threatened by, you know, a strong vocal woman. And I was working a lot in the community at the time, and I was very troubled by this because while I could certainly understand the critique of the feminists, and it wasn't that I didn't think the authorities of Nicolás Ruiz weren't capable of doing such a thing or being machista or whatever, what I knew was that the group of women who had most adamantly opposed her leadership were the Zapatista women, in other words, the more radical, organized women of the community. And so it seemed sort of alarming to me that it was the Zapatista women that would be engaged in shutting down women's power. It was counterintuitive to me.
Or at least had disagreements with the with this particular woman, as well as the women happened to be aligned with her faction.
Right. So when I went and did, you know, look into it more, what eventually became clear was that the Zapatista women were uncomfortable with her precisely because they felt that she was stepping outside this kind of collective women's group, that she was asserting herself too strongly. And they said to me, you know, we want women's rights, but we want to struggle for them collectively. And that's a quote that I use in the book that really struck me. It shouldn't have surprised me, because it was precisely at that time that at a national level, Zapatista women and indigenous women were meeting and responding to this public discourse by saying, look, we don't want the state to come in and protect our rights. We want autonomy for our communities. And within that context, we will renegotiate. There are problems with our gender norms. There are things that we don't like, and we will renegotiate them ourselves within our cultural context. Don't use us to keep our communities from having autonomy, and don't step in on our behalf to protect us. We don't need that kind of intervention.
In other words, the call for struggle within a community rather than calling on outside intervention from the state.
Absolutely, and to the extent that cultural changes in cultural norms needed to take place, they wanted the autonomy to redefine those within their cultural space and not have the state step in from outside and redefine them. So there was an interesting sort of negotiation of the individual and the collective in what those women were doing. They were saying, we as individual women have rights, and we will work on defining those within our cultural context, because we can't step out of that collective that is so much a part of our experience.
You worked for a couple of groups dealing with human rights during the time you were doing research on what eventually became your book. And one of them was Global Exchange, and the other one is an indigenous community human rights organization. Why don't you tell listeners a little bit about what that organization, Red de Defensores, is about?
Well, the Red de Defensores was formed in 1990, and it is a group, it's a network of indigenous human rights defenders. What we began to see as a real problem in Chiapas, as human rights organizations sort of mushroomed in the late 80s and early 90s, particularly after the uprising. And the work of the Catholic Diocese, which had the main human rights organization, also grew, was that indigenous communities were placed in a difficult situation in that there were always these NGO or church intermediaries. So if a human rights violation took place in a community, the people in the community had to come to the city, go to the organization, recount the facts of the event, and then the organization took that and made all the decisions about what was to be done. Should we have press releases? Should we be contacting the Ministerio Público? What would be done? What would be acted upon? And when all those decisions were made, not by the community that was affected, but by the organization. So
another paternalism, in other words.
Exactly. And a serious hindrance to indigenous people's ability to enact their autonomy and their self-definition. So the idea of the organization was to train people from communities in conflicted regions in Zapatista zones who were chosen by their authorities to work as part of a network. It didn't function as an NGO. Each of the defensores or defenders was primarily responded to their communities and their authority structure, rather than to a centralized structure of the organization. So basically, it was a network that allowed them to come together for training and for information sharing, but it was conceived sort of in concentric circles with the community at the center and the defensores in the middle, and then the NGOs and the press and the police and the courts and everything in circles around the outside of that.
And the indigenous communities actually chose the defensore.
The communities themselves chose the defensores.
And two defensores from each indigenous community.
That's right. Not from each community, but from each region.
Oh, each region, mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And basically what would happen if one of the things we talk about is the prospect about whether or not people are so attached to the organization that they become more distant from these indigenous communities. And in this case, they're held directly accountable to the communities in a given region such that if there is that distance, well, then they'll select a different defensore. And in some cases, you also mentioned people who had been defensores who left communities and became activists in their context in urban areas.
There were several defensores that eventually did that, and they were, of course, deauthorized by their authorities when they did so.
For that organization,
right. And they've continued to work. In fact, one of the defensores recently completed a law degree and is now one of the first acting indigenous attorneys in Chiapas. But that wasn't the model. That wasn't the goal. It wasn't to train them so that they could go into cities and do this work. They remained living in the communities and responding to community authorities. And it was allowed them to document human rights abuses much more quickly in the native language, with greater cultural sensitivity, a whole series of things that facilitated human rights documentation, as well as allowing them and forcing, for example, Ministerio Públicos who investigate crimes and judges to have to interact with and interact respectfully with indigenous people, which was a challenge at first because they had never had an indigenous person come before them as a rights defender in a legal capacity in that way, right? So they resisted it in many cases.
And this would be an indigenous person who is aware of their rights under international law.
Absolutely.
As well as the potential for claiming such rights under the revised Mexican Constitution.
Right.
You kind of experienced in your own kind of political trajectory, I guess, two models of the revolutionary taking of power. When you were in Nicaragua, I guess you worked for the state under the Sandinista government.
That's right.
Well, in this case, you're working in aligned with people themselves aligned with a revolutionary movement that has not seen state power but has found another form of power. And from this, you find a kind of, an insight developed by a political theorist by the name of Antonio Negri, mm-hmm. an Italian who's an author of several works, including a couple of books published in English with Michael Hart, mm-hmm. Empire and Multitude. Mm-hmm. Why don't you talk about the forms of power he discusses there?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I'll talk about it in relation to the Zapatistas and to what happened in Chiapas. The Zapatistas said from the start that they did not want to seize power. They wanted to exercise it. And, you know, I was in Chiapas for 8 years, and by the end of 8 years, it had become increasingly clear to me that that was precisely what they were doing through their autonomy project. They were exercising power. And in their assertion of rights in their exercise, they were making explicit that fact, that they had the right to exercise power and that their power came in its exercise. And that's very close to notions that Hart and Negri use in the book Empire, and as well as other theorists like Foucault, all of them draw on Spinoza in their theoretical work. And Spinoza had an argument about a body's power is coextensive with its ability to exercise its movement. And that argument applied to the social body is precisely what the Zapatistas were enacting, or that's what I argue in the book, that that power is coextensive with your ability to exercise it. So in a legal framework where rights have been granted to you by the sovereign, you may or may not be able to exercise those rights. And to the extent that you cannot exercise them, and this is something indigenous people were intimately familiar with in Chiapas, they functionally do not exist for you, right? So it doesn't surprise me that they elaborated a notion of rights based on the notion of their existence to the extent that they can are exercised or
that,
being exercised.
That's the voice of Shannon Speed, who's assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Texas at Austin. We're discussing her book, Rights and Rebellion, Indigenous Struggle and Human Rights in Chiapas. At this point, we're going to go to our weekly commentary from Rahul Mahajan. But first, this word.
This portion of co-op programming is brought to you in part by the Austin Independent Business Alliance, who wants you to shop local. You can shop local by visiting the Guadalupe Ibis District, which stretches from 29th to 32nd Street on Guadalupe, with 18 restaurants, 18 shops, and 10 services. You can find out more about AIBA and the other three Ibis districts at ibuyaustin.com. That's ibuyaustin.com.
You're listening to People United, this show in solidarity with the people of the world. I'm Alan Campbell. We now go to our weekly commentary from Rahul Mahajan, who this week talks about the tortured debate on torture. Here now is Rahul. You're listening to People United on KOP, Hornsby, Austin.
The administration's recent release of four Bush-era torture memos has unleashed a new flood of outraged commentary and denunciations of their inherent violence in the media, primarily in the Democratic partisan media. I feel torn between being glad that the crimes of the Bush administration are getting renewed attention, with even a few calls for accountability, and irritation at what our moral commentariat choose to focus on and why. But the irritation is winning out. To start with, all these documents do is add a little detail to what's been known for years. The renewed calls to impeach Jay Bybee, who sits on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, are well and good, but the original Bybee torture memo has been out in the public for many years. The new documents add some gruesome details about the various practices authorized, such as the fact that waterboarding was used 266 times on Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Abu Zubaydah, but it's still true that the practices authorized fall far short of what was actually done to detainees in Iraq and Afghanistan. In the past 3 years or so, the two issues that have received by far the most attention of the condemnatory kind are waterboarding and shutting down Guantanamo. According to the CIA and to all documents actually released, waterboarding was done on three people, including KSM, the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks, whose waterboarded testimony, by the way, anchored the 9/11 Commission report, which at the time occasioned hardly any comment. And treatment of detainees at Guantanamo, while atrocious, has been for many years much superior to treatment of detainees first at Abu Ghraib and Camp Bucca in Iraq, and all along at Bagram and other sites in Afghanistan. As of early 2005, the Associated Press had already found that at least 108 people had died in American custody. Accountability for those deaths has remained virtually non-existent, as has public curiosity about whether those numbers continue to mount. There also seems to be no curiosity about how many people have died because of the invasion and occupation of Iraq, or how many of those were killed by Americans. Some have tabulated the number of civilians killed in reported airstrikes in Afghanistan, but even this gets hardly any attention. Recently, the Times actually ran a short article speculating on the reason that the ongoing predator drone attacks in Pakistan are gleefully accepted, while the torture memos have caused, quote, years of recriminations, calls for prosecution, and national soul-searching. Of course, the premise is nonsense. There's no indication that the nation is soul-searching. It's merely a portion of the commentariat. The answer the article attempts to pose, that torture is somehow more intimate and immediate and that it's easier to imagine it used on oneself, is not terribly plausible. It is true in a general sense, and the anti-torture outcries of the early 1980s were so intense in part for this reason. And then the tortured included intellectuals, writers, and journalists. This time around, the top levels of our journalistic class are thoroughly insulated from the vicissitudes of life and quite unable to put themselves in the shoes of an Afghan taxi driver. Even the various bloggers who've taken up the cause do not seem to be acting primarily out of any sort of personal identification or empathic response. So what are the reasons behind this outrage? First, there's the precondition that liberals have completely accepted their own numerous arguments that torture is of no use since it only elicits false confessions. This happens to be nonsense, as anyone who watches the Battle of Algiers could figure out, but they believe it nonetheless. Drone attacks and bombing of Afghan villages, on the other hand, might just be advancing important goals in those countries, whatever the hell those goals are. Given this precondition, torture became several years ago a convenient issue for partisan differentiation and alignment. It is true that a great deal of commentary had to come out before Democratic politicians found the grit to say anything meaningful about it, but partisan Bush-hating had already become intense. Equally important is the fact that opposing torture is a cheap way to recapture one's own sense of smug morality. Even more than the Iraq War, it's been externalized and associated with a handful of actors, not even in general the legions of soldiers who abused and tortured people in Iraq, or the actual torturers themselves, or the on-the-ground CIA operatives, but simply a few Bush administration officials. It is easy to deal with, while our role in the destruction of one country and the ongoing chaos in another is not. For Empire Notes, this is Rahul Mahajan.
The Empire Notes, several Rahul Mahajan, our rare feature on People United. You've been listening to People United, the show in solidarity with the people of the world. I'm Alan Campbell. This week, People United featured University of Texas anthropologist Shannon Speed. We talked about her book, Rights and Rebellion, Indigenous Struggle, and Human Rights in Chiapas. Shannon Speed, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Alan. It's been fun.
And next week, we are going to be talking about the struggle for immigrant rights in this country. We'll have representatives from PODER, the ACLU, and Proyecto Defensa Laboral, as well as from the Austin Immigrant Rights Coalition. Again, our regular commentary is by Rahul Mahajan. I'm Alan Campbell. Now, coming up next on KOP Hornsby Austin is Texas Politics Today with Dees Eckstein and David Kubarowski.
This is KOOP Hornsby Austin 91.7 on your FM dial, your community radio station. Welcome to Texas Politics Today, the only weekly radio show covering Texas state and local politics. Texas Politics Today airs every Friday from 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock p.m. Central Time.
I was walking down the street in the town I was born. I was moving to a beat that I never felt before. A silhouette opened up my eyes and I took a look around. Saw you written across the sky.
turn around. All our hopes have come to be. And people gather around. They are all what they can bring. Nobody went with that. Only little song to sing. The revolution starts now.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. The revolution starts now on KOOP, your community radio station. This is DSEX, and you're listening to Texas Politics Today, as you do every Friday afternoon from 2 to 3 p.m. here on KOOP, your community radio station. Joining me, as always, in the studio, my colleague and friend David Koborowski. David, how are you?
Not bad. A little cloudy out there today, Dees. We're heading into the summer season here, very close to the heat and the hot and the humidity, but it's not quite there yet. So we're in that transitional zone where it's starting to get a little muggy out there.